This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the American Monetary Association's podcast, where we explore how monetary policy impacts the real lives of real people and the action steps necessary to preserve wealth and enhance one's lifestyle.
It's my pleasure to welcome Matthew J. Martin. He is the founder and CEO of Blossom Finance. He became a Muslim about 8 years ago and has some very interesting insights into cryptocurrencies and how they are viewed under Sharia law and also debt. You may not be familiar with this, but there are some very defined rules under Sharia law as far as debt goes. So we're going to dive into that and talk about it. I read an article about this in Forbes a while back, and I found it to be a fascinating topic, and it's interesting to see how the community is dealing with these subjects. So let's dive in. Matthew, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and thank you for having me, Jason. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you. Tell us, are you located in San Francisco area?
I'm not. I lived in San Francisco 11 years, but I've been 3 years here in Jakarta, Indonesia.
Oh, you're in Jakarta. Okay, I've been to Jakarta before. Yeah, and you have a San Francisco phone number, so that's why I asked.
That's true.
And your company also does microfinance in Indonesia as well, right?
That's correct. We're focused in Central Java. It's by far the best and most developed region for Islamic microfinance in the world. So every time I visit the people in the field, I'm incredibly just inspired by the work they're doing.
Okay. Since we're on the topic of microfinance, let's just talk about that for a moment. You know, my charitable foundation's been a big supporter of Kiva over the years. You know, I really like this part of the financial world. I think it is going to be the solution to lift people out of poverty and, you know, move more people around the world into the middle class. But there are a couple different areas of it, and I think I, as well as other people, tend to sort of lump them all together, as you will, in the world of microfinance. So sure. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about that. I mean, are these, you know, the typical sort of $75 loans or $300 loans where people put in $25 each? That's kind of the Kiva model. But there's a lot more to it than that, obviously, right?
Absolutely. So microfinance generally has been misappropriated to mean any amount of lending that's at a very small ticket size. And unfortunately, there's actually a lot of basically digital loan sharks that have emerged that says, hey, we're doing microfinance. But as it turns out, they're just giving money to people and then people go spend that on new cell phones, new clothes, etc. And it actually takes a poor person and creates a poor person with debt as opposed to taking a poor person and making them less poor, which is the goal. So the way we look at microfinance is we look at the micro in terms of the entrepreneur. What is their current household income? And then can we grow that through financing them? So our ticket size does go all the way down to $100 or even less. But we think of microfinance as it can be a larger ticket size as long as it's taking a micro entrepreneur and helping them out to be more successful with the goal of increasing overall household income. Yeah, Kiva is obviously one of the best, successful, and most notable examples of microfinance that consumers can participate in. In our model, we use more of a fund approach. So one thing that's very difficult for a lot of microfinance institutions is if you're doing $100 per person, you can imagine it becomes very difficult for every single person who walks through the door to tell their life story, to tell about their business, to take pictures, et cetera, and to post that. Versus our model is we tell a few of those stories, but we really just take a big chunk of money, give it to a microfinance cooperative. So these cooperatives are owned and managed by the local communities for the benefit of the communities. And the model we really like in Indonesia is called the BMT model, which stands for Baitul Mal dan Tamwil, which combines commercial financing for profit with a second side, which is creating social enterprise for the benefit of the poor. So they do this commercial financing activity that helps micro entrepreneurs, which is, you know, chiefly what microfinance is about. But on the other side, they take some of their operational profits and put that to work creating businesses for the benefit of the poor that actually solve local problems. For example, one of the microfinance institutions we work with recognized there was a lot of garbage in the neighborhood, in their area. And so they created a trash collection business, and people in the community pay a fee to have trash collected. They fix the problem of trash in the community, and it's owned and operated by someone who previously was unemployed. So not only have they solved a social problem, but they've also created a self-sustaining business that generates an income for a local entrepreneur.
Yeah, very good. Well, I tell you, one of the best documentaries I've seen on the subject of helping the poor, or I should say not helping the poor, would be Poverty Inc. You're probably familiar with this.
Yes.
The folks at Kiva I spoke with said there's a lot of talk about that at Kiva. This is so much better than the tragic consequences of the Clinton Foundation, you know, even Bono, you know, with U2, but he's come around, it seems like, that he gets the disaster. Tom Shoes, they talk about all of the problems these charitable organizations are causing, because every time the economy in one of these developing areas sort of starts up, right, there's a guy making shoes, for example, then Tom Shoes will come along with a big truck, and you never have any idea when they're going to come, and they give everybody shoes, so they put the shoemaker out of business. It's just, it's charity can really hurt people. So I love the micro lending concept because it's a hand up, not a hand out. You know, it's a more predictable thing. There's not just these tons of oversupply of rice or shoes or, you know, whatever it happens to be. So good for you in engaging in that. I'm really glad you're doing it. Let's talk about the Islamic world and talk about the way they view debt and the way they view cryptocurrency. And, you know, maybe some of the listeners are thinking, well, why is this important to me? I'm not a Muslim. What does it have to do with me? And so maybe I'll pose that question to you. I have a couple thoughts on it, but why don't you take it?
Sure. So, I mean, the high level, approximately 1 in 4 people in the entire world are Muslim. So if you are at all interested in markets, emerging markets, business, commerce, you know, 1 in 4 people in the world are Muslim. So understanding that segment is obviously important, just from a pure profit-driven business perspective. Now, the way Islam views debt is actually the same way that classical Christianity and classical Judaism also viewed debt. So all three of those Abrahamic faiths traditionally prohibited debt. And over time, the views on that evolved where, you know, Jews became lenders to non-Jews, and then later sort of, I mean, still to this day, Orthodox Jews cannot participate in lending to other Jews with interest. Christianity, same thing. The Catholic Church for hundreds of years prohibited lending with interest, and that's why the Jews kind of were able to fill this niche. They were prohibited in society and sort of stigmatized and prohibited from other trades, but the Catholic Church didn't allow Christians to lend with interest, so the Jews kind of came in and filled this role, which contributed to a lot of anti-Semitism because they were the moneylenders, right? And just, you know, how dare you be successful at the only thing we allowed you to do is kind of the historical truth there. But, you know, so Islam is an extension of those traditions and takes the same view that debt-based lending is a model that tends to make the poor poorer at the enrichment of the wealthy. And so instead of debt, Islam encourages equity ownership, risk participation, and models that really favor someone believing in a business model, believing in an entrepreneur, and participating with them in something that's profitable and productive to society, broadly speaking.
Okay, good. So in my real estate investment company, I always sort of half-jokingly say debt is my favorite four-letter word, because when it's investment-grade debt and we're not paying our own debts, it can be hugely beneficial. I mean, you understand how real estate deals work, I'm sure. You get leverage, you get inflation destroying the value of the debt, so you pay it back in cheaper dollars over time. You outsource the debt obligation to the tenants. You don't actually pay the debt yourself, et cetera. And we certainly have a decent number of Muslim clients. So are they just non-traditional Muslims that aren't really following the letter of Sharia law, or have they just kind of modernized their beliefs, or, you know, what's going on there? Or is it okay when you don't have to have a lot of faith in it, like a startup business or something, which is highly risky, and, you know, you're paying your own debts? I don't know. I'm just throwing out some food for thought there.
Sure. So the quick and easy answer is any Muslim that takes a loan or especially gives a loan with interest is breaking the rules, right? Breaking the rules of their religion. That's the simple high level answer. Now, there's a caveat there that is, in Islam, anything that becomes a necessity for you to live, anything that's classically or normally not permissible can become permissible. Perfect example is, let's say you're lost and you're wandering in the desert and you come upon a dead animal that's rotting there in the desert. So in Muslim food, we are not allowed to eat basically carrion or food that's already dead. It has to be butchered, right, in a proper way, just like, you know, Jews have kosher. So same type of concept. However, Islam recognizes that the preservation of life is the most important thing. So if you're wandering in the desert and the only thing to drink, for example, is wine, you know, Islam does not allow drinking of alcohol. But if that's the only thing there is to drink and you'll die otherwise, it becomes halal, meaning it becomes permissible for you. So translate that now to America, for example, where there's a Muslim minority population. Muslims need a place to live, right? So if a Muslim has no other option and they have to take a mortgage to buy a house to have a place to live, that mortgage becomes permissible for them. But let me add some conditions here. If they have an option of renting, right, and renting in a safe place, and they have other viable options, then it's not permissible. But if it's really the only option for them, then all the vast majority of scholars would say that loan, taking out that loan, becomes permissible for them because there's no other option, right? But unfortunately, the reality is even in places like Indonesia that have Islamic banking facilities and have Sharia-compliant financing products, you'll find a large percentage of Muslims, even here in Indonesia, the world's biggest Muslim country, taking out those sort of loans, taking out conventional loans. It's very confusing to me. I often joke and say, you know, if you ask a Muslim on the street in Indonesia, would you go into a restaurant that serves pork? They say, no, I would never go into a restaurant that serves pork. So then why are they not afraid to walk into a bank that deals with interest, when interest is actually the warning and the penalty in Islam for dealing in interest is much, much more severe than something like pork, which is like a minor sin. It's not even one of the major sins. So there's definitely a cognitive dissonance there between the beliefs and what Muslims know to be permissible and not permissible versus what Muslims do in practice. And I'm not talking about Muslims who go out and, you know, Muslims who are not praying and drinking alcohol, etc., who say, oh, I'm a cultural Muslim, but I'm not practicing. I'm talking about Muslims that pray five times a day, who fast the month of Ramadan, who go out and take out a loan for a car. So there definitely is a cognitive dissonance amongst the global Muslim population around debt.
Okay. So what are they doing to get around this? What do they do instead? They do equity share deals. They do
absolutely,
leases.
Absolutely.
Like a lease is okay, right? I mean, you can, in a lot of deals, leasing is virtually the same as buying, okay? And then instead of a loan, you have a lease. Like, for example, you go get a new car, right? And you can lease it. Yes, it's not called a loan. It's a lease. You're supposed to turn it in at the end. But it's the same basic result, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And equity, I would say, is the most Islamic financing model. So where you're actually an owner in the business, you're an investor, even if you're a silent investor, that's the gold standard in terms of Islamic finance. So if you are a car dealership and you give someone credit terms, let's say, for example, I walk into your dealership and you say, this car costs $25,000. And I say, you know, I don't have all the money today. You say, no problem. You can make a monthly payment of $1,000, but you'll do it over the next 3-4 years. So ultimately, the car will cost you twice as much, but you'll be buying it on credit from me, the car seller. That's completely permissible in Islam. So credit sale is completely allowed. The issue becomes when there's a third party that's coming in and just providing money as the product.
Oh,
so when the
weird.
Object of
yeah.
sale is money itself, that's where it becomes what's known as riba, or interest-based financing. So credit debts are completely allowed.
Folks, let's just take a step back from that. That's really kind of fascinating here. So if you sell something to someone and you carry the paper, like if you own a house and you sell the house to someone else and you carry the paper as the seller, a seller carry back, the seller carries the note, there's no outside financing, that's okay under Sharia. But if a bank comes in, a third party, and makes that loan, that's not okay. But interestingly, the seller could make that loan and carry the paper, if you will, and then sell the paper off to a third party. So kind of the same result. It's kind of odd.
That's right. So yeah, the key difference in those transactions being, in one, the object of sale with the bank is money, versus with a credit sale, the object of sale is the house, the car, the actual thing that's an object of sale. And Islam recognizes the seller has the right to charge any price for any reason. It's their property. If you say, I'll pay cash today, I give you a $100,000 price. If you want it over 5 year or 10 year, it's $500,000. Islam completely acknowledges and recognizes that is the right of the seller. It's only when this third party with a money as a product comes in, that's where it becomes impermissible. And also a bank could get involved, but the bank has to have risk participation, right? The bank has to take over if the bank takes the deed of the house and then does a lease to own or even does a credit sale with you, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. But what Islam doesn't want is the bank comes in just with the money and they're this third party in the transaction, and they're basically just using money to make money without any underlying asset or risk or transaction there.
Well, you know, I mean, many people have argued, and I would have to agree with most of them, that Wall Street is this epic scam, and the whole financial services industry is this epic scam because their product is money. And, you know, there have been movies about this. I mean, I'm not the first one to say it. You know, how they really don't necessarily create any real value in the world. They just relabel things, repackage them, move them around, and charge people fees to change the composure of things. You know, they call it financial innovation, Martin, which everybody should view as a very scary phrase, because whenever you hear Wall Street talk about financial innovation, you better run for the hills.
Grab your wallet. Yeah, hold your wallet tightly.
Hide your wallet.
You hear that,
yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
But what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, if you look at it, it's a lot of risk transfer. So the crisis of 2008, what we saw is these products that nobody understood, they were basically completely toxic under the hood. It was risk transfer from one party to another, to another, to another. And all these smart PhD analysis of these situations said, oh, well, our capital at risk is very low, et cetera, because no one was accounting for it. At the end of the day, someone is holding the bag. Someone has the risk. And people just assume they could infinitely transfer away all the risk and just make this money and sell it down the river. And that sort of model is what Islam is against. Islam is about risk participation, right? The justification of profit is that you have some risk there. And Islam, you know, Islam is concerned with creating value and creating wealth and preserving that wealth. And so there's nothing, profit is not a dirty word in Islam. Profit is encouraged. If something's not profitable, that's how you know it's not a beneficial economic activity, right? And so you need that risk participation to really have those true market discovery forces at work. And that's really, really important. By the way, in Islam also, you cannot sell a debt. So if I give you a loan, in Islam, I can give you a loan, but I can't give it to you with interest. So it's considered a charity. If you are lacking capital for some reason, like let's say you don't have money to eat, and I give you money to eat, to have a safe place, whatever. Well, that's a bad example because in Islam, you have to give money for people to eat. So let's say you want to buy a car and I just do it to you as a charity. I say, you know what, you need to buy a car. I think this is going to help you. I'll give you a zero interest loan. That's fine. I cannot then take that loan agreement and sell it to someone else. That's not permissible in Islam, right? So what you see is actually the business cycles in an Islamic economy are much, much more compact. So you don't have big swings of credit availability and then bust. The boom and bust cycle is not so wide. Obviously, there's some business cycling that's happening there, but because there's not just this expansive debt creation, monetary creation, the business cycles are much more stable, sort of steady state, predictable stepwise growth. So it's a very much more predictable sort of steady growth in the economy is what you see.
Okay, so you're kind of making the macro argument that the system we have currently with central banking and so forth makes the entire economic system a lot less stable, the financial services world, the financial industry, because of the way it's structured. But if that were run under the Sharia concept, where there was this equity participation and risk participation, it would be much more even keel, which is oddly what the promise of the Federal Reserve was over 100 years ago, but they didn't keep their promise, obviously, because we've had huge swings and they've been very violent. Is that what you're saying? That system would make it more stable? It's interesting.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about, if you have to have risk participation, you really have to believe about that underlying business, those underlying assets. It's not just about the mere credit ability, the ability of someone to repay the money. It's really about the underlying value of the asset. And you can see that in what's called the sukuk market. So the sukuk market is the Islamic economy alternative to the bond market and the debt market. Sukuk is, instead of based on credit and debt, it's based on assets. So when someone stops paying, so a common structure used in sukuk is a lease-based agreement. So a government can, for example, sell one of their national assets. Let's say they sell a toll road. And the investors now own an asset. They own a highway. The way investors make money is the government makes a lease payment on that asset. So what happens if the government stops paying the lease payment? Well, guess what? The investors have an asset. Instead of having a bad debt, they actually have an asset. So you can see how that whole system, now to make that work, you have to clarify the ownership of the asset, make sure the asset correctly value the asset, all those types of things. So it's not just this magic creation of money through debt. It's, you actually have to really believe in the underlying model, believe in the asset, and properly value the asset based on the market price. So it's just a very different way of conceiving of a global financial system.
Right, really
and
interesting.
Some people would call it, rather than call it Islamic finance, some people have termed it participation finance. It's a term that was used in Turkey. In Turkey, because they have a secular government, they prohibited the term Islamic finance and instead used the term participation finance. Hmm. And that really kind of captures the spirit of what's going on, is there's risk participation and risk sharing. Yeah. And those are principles that are universal. They're not specific to Islam. Islam just happens to require them of Muslims.
Yeah. Well, I think they're pretty good principles. So that's quite interesting. I'm glad you explained that. Well, you know, the major subject of this talk was supposed to be about cryptocurrency. We didn't quite get there yet. But let's end with that. The Islamic world seems to view things that are solid and real as having value, intrinsic value, gold, silver, etc. These are real commodities. They have a long track record. I mean, cryptocurrency is almost worse than fiat money, and I would argue, because it's literally created out of thin air. At least fiat money has, meaning dollars and euros and things like that, has a standing army behind it. Right. So, and a government supporting it as part of the big conspiracy. But what would you say about the Islamic view of the cryptocurrency world?
Sure. So a common misconception even Muslims have is they think that only assets like gold and silver can be monetized in Islam. And that's actually not true. So in Sunni Islam, which is the, you know, 85% of Muslims, there's four major schools of Islamic thought. Three of them all universally recognize that intangible things can be assets. For example, I offer you a ride in my car. I say, you know what? You can take a ride in my car anytime you want. Just tell me. You own an asset. Is that a tangible asset? No, it's intangible. But yet, you nevertheless, you own an asset. The asset is a ride in my car. The classical example is a ride on a camel that actually the scholars use. The dissenting opinion there also recognize that things that are not classically property, that are, they classified only tangible things as property, they said through customary use in the marketplace, it could become property. And the example of that in our modern world is intellectual property, copyrights, trademarks, all those things are recognized by all four schools of Islamic thought as being assets, as being valid property in the Sharia. So then you take that a step further and say, okay, well, if intangible things can be property, then cryptocurrency also can be property. Yes, it is an intangible thing, but it fulfills all the requirements from an economic perspective of money, plus it fulfills the core requirement of being able to be property, being able to be Islamically recognized as a thing of property, meaning it can be transferred, it can be possessed, it can be transferred between people, and it's something that people generally treat as having value. So cryptocurrency, although it is intangible, Islam recognizes that some intangible things can have value and can become, through customary usage, the property. And so regarding fiat currency, Islam also recognizes that something can become money through government mandate. That can be good or bad, depending upon where you live and the history of your whoever the issuer of the currency is. But the nice thing about cryptocurrency is at least the rules about how much currency will be created or the inflationary or deflationary principles of it are known and are not subject to political manipulation. So that can have some very beneficial effects on the economy, on society. And from an Islamic perspective, Islam discourages too much uncertainty, what's called gharar. So that is a very nice, and by the way, also the Islamic rules for changing money, money must be traded hand to hand, meaning when you trade money from one currency to another or gold to silver, etc., that transaction must settle instantly on a cash basis. You cannot have binary options trading, for example, in Islamic finance. So the great thing about cryptocurrency is if you're using the blockchain, there's a mathematical proof that you have ownership of those assets and they're transferred on a cash basis. So it eliminates a whole category of questionable transactions from an Islamic monetary perspective, which is really interesting, you know, and really in line with Sharia principles.
Okay, so the bottom line is that cryptocurrencies are okay?
They are okay. However, if you live in a country that prohibits them by law, then they're not permissible Islamically, because Islam recognizes that the law of the land supersedes the Sharia law. So if you live in a country like Germany, Germany has already said Bitcoin is money. So if you live in Germany and you're a Muslim, guess what? It's very clear. No matter what any scholar says, The government said Bitcoin is money, therefore Bitcoin is money for Muslims in Germany. If you live in Indonesia, where I do, Bitcoin is, it's legal to have it as an asset. It's legal to buy and sell, but it is not legal for payment. So if you live in Indonesia, you cannot, as a Muslim with a conscience, you cannot use Bitcoin for payment simply because it's illegal.
Interesting. Okay. So the law of the land takes precedence. You know, I bet a lot of people would have something to say about that, given the Muslim immigration in various westernized countries. And, you know, there are problems. I mean, it seems like a lot of Muslims haven't accepted that the law of the land is above Sharia law. What, am I wrong on that?
You're absolutely right. It's 100% clear that the law of the land supersedes Sharia law. However, if the law of the land, for example, in China, so in China, there's rules that say Muslims cannot fast, and they're forcing Muslims to not fast during the month of Ramadan. So if there's a law that explicitly is removing the rights of the Muslim, that is a different story, right? So the cases of that would be like, you know, a law prohibiting you from praying. In France, for example, laws banning the use of the niqab. Those are areas where Muslims, we see Muslims saying, no, you know, it's my right to do this and it's part of my religion and I refuse to comply with the law that's, and the great thing about the United States is the United States has that enshrined in the law of the land, in the Constitution, that the government shall make no law that prohibits the free worship of religion. So the United States doesn't have some of the problems that France has, for example, creating an anti-niqab law. But other than that, if it's not infringing on your rights as a Muslim, then you absolutely must comply with the law of the land. The contentious area of that is of course, something like polygamy. A man in Sharia is allowed up to four wives as long as he can provide for them financially and treat them with equity and justice. So a Muslim living in America, for example, where polygamy is illegal, might say, well, that's infringing on my right as a Muslim. Now, some Muslim scholars argue, well, if you live in a place where that's illegal, how can you do justice to them? Because they won't have the same status under the law of the land, therefore polygamy for you is not allowed. And there's a dispute about that in the Muslim community. Hmm. But you know, by and large, as long as a law is not infringing on your right as a Muslim, you must obey that law. You must obey the law of the land. Hmm. And we have examples from that in classical Islam of early Muslims back to the 7th and 8th century going into non-Muslim lands and how what was their adab or what was their behavior and etiquette in the non-Muslim lands and et cetera. So we have beautiful examples in classical Islam of that.
Very interesting. This has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you for sharing some of these things. And please give out your website.
You're welcome. So you can learn more about Blossom at blossomfinance.com.
All right, good stuff. Blossomfinance.com. Matthew Martin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Jason.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.